time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today we are going to be talking with our guest, Dr. Jennifer Martin. She is a professor of medicine at UCLA and she works a lot with sleep issues. And today in particular, we're going to be talking about sleep and the elderly. So welcome, Dr. Martin.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm glad you were able to join us because I attended a presentation that you had given previously, and I was enthralled by the information, really appreciated the way you were able to talk about it, and I thought my audience would certainly want to know more. So I'm going to dive right in.
Sounds good.
As we talk about sleep on this show, specifically, let's talk about sleep and people as they age. And can you tell us, are there differences as people get older, or is it just in our minds?
That is a really important question. There are a couple of things that change in a very systematic way as people get older. And then there are other things that I would say are kind of myths about things that happen to sleep as people get older. So two things that we know from years and years of science that change from, say, young adulthood to older adulthood are, number one, our internal clock shifts. And what I mean by that, a lot of people are familiar with the term circadian rhythms now. So Our circadian rhythms tend to go from, you know, younger people tend to be kind of night owls. A lot of us probably remember when we were college students or in our early 20s, maybe having our first job. It's kind of hard to settle down and go to sleep at night and pretty hard to get up for that 8 a.m. commitment in the morning. But as we age, our internal clock shifts earlier. And so the kinds of issues that are faced by older adults are that they might have a hard time staying awake in the evening. You know, you might notice dozing off, trying to watch television, or, you know, shifting your evening meal, your dinner time earlier. And then older folks tend to wake up early in the morning. There's nothing actually wrong with this if you can adapt your lifestyle to that kind of a transition. I've had, you know, patients I've worked with over the years who were perfectly happy getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning as long as they got a decent night of sleep and they'd, you know, be the first ones out on the golf course. So there's that shift in internal circadian rhythms. The second thing is that when we're young, especially when people are still growing, we get a lot of deep sleep. I can say more about that later if you'd like. But The important thing here is that during deep sleep, or what we sometimes refer to as non-REM stage 3 sleep, it's really hard to wake someone up. So it has to be a loud noise to wake them up or a big disturbance. I think a lot of us have had the experience of, you know, looking at our own kids when they're 20 years old and thinking, I can't believe they sleep through all this noise. Well, part of that is because of the architecture of their sleep. As we age, we get less and less deep sleep. So it's common for someone to say, gosh, you know, I've lived near this bus station, you know, my whole life. It never used to wake me up. And now every time that, you know, the bus pulls out at 5 a.m., it wakes me up. Mm-hmm. So that is because of changes in how much deep sleep we get as we age. Now, the third thing I mentioned is that there are some myths out there. One is that older people just don't need to sleep. That, you know, as you get older, you know, you can just sleep 5 hours and that's fine. Those kinds of statements came from old studies where we failed to account for the fact that older people take more naps than younger people. So if we added up how much sleep they were getting over 24 hours, it was pretty similar to the amount of sleep that they got when they were younger. So older people might need a little bit less sleep than younger people, but it's not that big of a difference.
So, if you know, like in my experience, for example, as I talk to patients who are in, let's say, their 70s and 80s, typically a common part of the discussion will be, you know, I'm waking up really early and I never used to wake up so early. is there something wrong? You know, can I fix that? I want to sleep later. What's going on there?
Well, so there's a couple of things that might be going on there. One is actually more of like a social factor, which is that a lot of times when we're young and in our working years, we have to get up at a certain time in the morning. And then in our later years, maybe we stop working, maybe by choice, maybe because of health issues, but we no longer have to get up so early. So what a lot of older folks do is they spend more time in bed. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you used to go to bed at, you know, say 10 o'clock and get up at 5 to start your work day, once you stop working, you might not want to get up at 5 o'clock anymore. But for some people, they can just shift the timing so they could stay up later and get up later. What I hear a lot, though, is that people still go to bed at 10 o'clock, but now they want to sleep until 7. And unfortunately, you can't buy yourself more sleep than you need. So right. I usually suggest that people reflect on a schedule that worked for them in the past where they were sleeping well, and then think about how similar what they're doing now lines up with what they used to do. Mm-hmm. And this can be really important, as I mentioned earlier, because older people have a natural tendency to wake up earlier anyway. So, you know, we kind of have to do the math. If I used to feel really good with 7.5 hours in bed and now I'm spending 9 hours in bed, you won't get 9 hours of sleep. You'll be awake for an hour and a half at some point during the night.
Right, right. So, and then you also mentioned the fact that naps start to become more available to us, even if we're not, you know, in the workplace and we're at home,
you know,
then we have the luxury.
I really like the way you said that naps become available to us. I think that's a really nice way of describing it, because it's not necessarily a bad thing to take a nap. You just have to remember that if you take a nap, you're not going to need as much sleep at night. So mm-hmm. if you know, there are parts of the world where everyone takes a nap every day, and that's okay, right? The kind of siesta cultures. But if you look at their nighttime sleep patterns, they stay up very late. So they'll take a nap for an hour in the afternoon, but then they don't go to bed until 12. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, a number of older folks that I work with, they want that nap. It's really kind of feels like a luxury. Right. But then they still want to go to bed at 10 and be in bed till 7 in the morning. And those things just don't all go together.
Right. So then that begs the question, what is the better advice? Is it to try to not take the nap so that you get a more consistent sleep at night? Or is it accept the fact that, you know, you won't have a longer sleep at night, but naps will be available?
I don't know if there really is a right answer for everyone. I think it depends on what's important to you. One thing I will say is that sometimes, you know, people, especially people in their, maybe in their 80s or even 90s, they find it really difficult to stay awake all day into the mm-hmm. evening. So if you want to be active in the evening, taking a nap may help you maintain alertness a little better. Mm-hmm. I actually was just visiting my 97-year-old grandmother this past weekend. And, you know, she takes a nap every day and kind of enjoys it. And it does give her enough, you know, kind of energy and alertness to get through the evening without feeling sleepy and, you know, sleeping through her favorite TV shows or missing phone calls from her sisters or things like that. So I think, again, the most important thing is that you just have to be aware that if you take that nap, it does mean that you're going to need a little bit less sleep during the night.
Right, right. So we've been talking about sort of this natural shift in regular sleeping patterns and all mm-hmm. as we age. But as we age, are there diagnosable sleep disorders that start to become more prevalent, or what should we be thinking about?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, because one of the ways we think about it is that it's not the need for sleep so much that changes as people get older. It's their ability to sleep. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest issues that comes up with age is sleep apnea. So sleep apnea is a sleep disorder where, you know, a person has no trouble breathing necessarily during the day, but when they lay down to sleep, breathing becomes more difficult. So you can think about when you're awake, breathing is voluntary, meaning you can make yourself do it. When you fall asleep, breathing is involuntary. So different systems in your body kind of take over and help you breathe while you're not trying, basically. So there's two different kinds of sleep apnea. One is where the person's airway closes, and that can be due to having extra weight. It can be due to loss of muscle tone. It can be due to a number of different factors, but, you know, it's kind of like a deflated balloon. Your airway doesn't stay open. Mm-hmm. There's another kind of sleep apnea where kind of your brain and the physiological systems don't tell you to breathe. And that tends to be more common in people who have some cardiac conditions like heart failure. But because of that, we wake up a lot at night. So our brain won't let us, you know, die during the night from not breathing. It just wakes us up and then that voluntary system kicks back in. Mm-hmm. So that is called sleep apnea in general. It gets more common with age, and there's a huge change in women from before to after menopause. So sleep apnea is about 3 times more common in women after menopause compared to before. That's probably the most common big change in sleep disorders prevalence. Okay. You know, it used to be that older people complained about and had insomnia disorder more than younger people. But now we're actually seeing more and more insomnia in younger people, too. So it's not that older people don't have it. It's just becoming more common in younger people. So when I refer to insomnia disorder, I mean, you know, trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, or those early morning awakenings that we talked about that happen frequently, like at least 3 times a week. In order to diagnose insomnia disorder, it has to go on for at least 3 months, and it has to affect how the person feels during the day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I mentioned, some people, they're fine getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and having the earliest tea time. That's not insomnia. But if they are struggling with sleep and they're trying to sleep more and it's really bothering them and they're tired all day long, well, then that actually could be an insomnia problem. So even though that doesn't seem to be more common in older people, it still probably affects somewhere between 1 out of 4 and 1 out of 5 older adults.
Wow. So while we're talking about insomnia, let me ask this. So as you described, you've got people who have trouble falling asleep, then you have people who have trouble staying asleep, and then you have people who wake too early, right?
Yep.
And my question, and after my question, I'm going to take a commercial break and then we'll come back and answer it. But my question to you is, does the type of insomnia change based on our age, or is it based on the individual person? So let me stop us for a quick commercial break. We'll come back and we'll answer that question.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, we are back on Sleep Science Today with Dr. Jennifer Martin. Just before the break, we were asking about insomnia and the types of insomnia and whether it is affected by age. So, Dr. Martin, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. So, you hit on something really important, which is that because of those natural changes in our circadian rhythm or kind of our daily cycles, we do see more complaints about trouble staying asleep or waking up too early in the morning in older people compared to younger people. So the most common type of insomnia in young people is trouble falling asleep. Mm-hmm. And what we call sleep maintenance insomnia is more common in older adults. The good news is the way we treat it is the same. The challenge is, of course, that when older people are up in the middle of the night, there's not a lot to do. And sometimes we worry about, things like falling at night, especially if you have to take medications that might make your balance unsteady or things like that. But yeah, it's definitely that more sleep maintenance problem that we see in older folks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and then you just hit upon my next question there, which is, it's not uncommon to hear a lot of people, period, today, but especially when you're talking to elderly folks, about the sleeping medications that they take, and they've got to have their medicine or they're not going to be able to sleep. What's going on there?
Well, we do know that older people are more likely to get a prescription for a sleeping pill than younger people. So they're whether that's because they ask, because their doctors are more willing to prescribe, it's hard to say. But the highest rates of sleeping pill prescriptions are in older people. The other thing is that, we worry a little bit about sleeping pill use in older adults because they tend to take a lot of other medications that can interact with sleeping pills.
Right.
I can't tell you how often I get asked the question, what can I buy that's natural? What about a supplement? What about melatonin? What about valerian? And if you really look at, randomized trials where they compare, some of those over-the-counter supplements to a sugar pill, a placebo, they're not very effective. So, on the other hand, I always tell people, if you took a sugar pill and you believed it was going to work, it would help you fall asleep faster.
Right.
So we know there's a very strong placebo effect. But to your specific question about medications, the other concern we have in addition to interaction with other drugs is that issue of balance at night. So any kind of a sleeping pill that can affect your balance or has a potential side effect of confusion, we're really cautious about giving those to older people, especially for long-term use.
Mm-hmm. So just for my own clarification on what you were describing there, if someone were taking prescription sleep pills, okay, versus over-the-counter, if that same person did not take those pills, in reality, based on the science that you're aware of, would it honestly, evidence-based answer, make any difference?
In the short term, yes, and in the long term, no. So if you take a pill every night and then you don't take it, the experience that people usually have is, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to sleep tonight because I didn't take my sleeping pill.
Mm-hmm.
There's a recent study that I saw presented at the sleep conference last year where they gradually switched from the active medication to placebo. And that works pretty well, especially if you implement it alongside other strategies to sleep better. So the short answer is yes. When you rip off the Band-Aid, the first few nights are hard because not because of any kind of dependence on the chemical part of the drug, but because of the anxiety that it creates for us when we don't take it.
Right.
If you just stop taking it after a few nights, you'll go back to probably sleeping the way you were on the sleeping pill. That's mm-hmm. that's the scientific answer, is that
right.
There's short-term disruption in sleep. But the truth is, if you look at the effect of prescription sleeping pills compared to a placebo, for example, it might extend the amount of sleep you get by 15 minutes a night. So
wow.
If right now you sleep 5.5 hours and you're awake for 3 hours in the middle of the night, the sleeping pill, the active drug part of it, doesn't have a very big impact.
Right.
The placebo effect, meaning your belief that it will work, has a much bigger impact. And so when you stop taking it, you stop getting the placebo benefit too.
Right, right. So then in your knowledge, are there any prescription sleep drugs outside of the placebo effect, so the actual medicinal effect, that provide restful sleep? Or is it simply maybe they'll knock you out, but you don't get the restful sleep that you would normally get naturally?
That's a great question. So the sleeping pills, different types of sleeping pills are a little different, but they do change the kind of sleep that you get. And so sleep that you get on a sleeping pill is not the same as natural sleep. It's almost the same, but it's not exactly the same. So it tends to get you more of those lighter stages of sleep, which for some people don't feel quite as refreshing, and not more of the deep sleep or, you know, the things that I think really help people feel rested when they wake up.
Right.
In general, the other issue is that a number of sleeping pills are specifically not recommended for older adults by the American Geriatric Society. So, you know, we want to, again, really be thoughtful about things that affect memory and cognition or thinking and anything that would increase the risk of an older person getting up and having a fall at night.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are a number of sleeping pills that are on a list of do not prescribe, according to the American Geriatric Society.
Well, that's good to know. Okay. Mm-hmm. So given all of that, what do you say or what do you do? You've got an elderly patient who comes to you and they say, I haven't been able to sleep for the last 3 nights and I have tried everything and I don't know what to do and I'm not sleeping at all. What's going on there and what type of treatments are available for someone like
sure.
that?
Well, there's really two different things that can happen. If somebody comes to me and says, I haven't had a decent night of sleep for 3 nights, I usually say, don't worry about it. You'll sleep tonight. Because the more sleep deprived you are, the more hungry your brain gets for sleep and the more likely you'll have a good night of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a bad night of sleep now and then, especially in response to some kind of stress or anxiety. The metaphor I like to use is that, you know, if there was a bear parading around outside your bedroom, it would be a really bad idea to fall asleep, right? You would need to stay awake.
Right.
So if you have some kind of stress and you can't sleep because of that for a few days, it's perfectly normal. It's like losing your appetite when you're upset. It's mm-hmm. just a normal response. What I tend to hear more often is, I haven't been able to sleep for 15 years. Every once in a while I get a decent night, but most of the time I get in bed and I just struggle. In that instance, the best available treatment is something called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And mm-hmm. I mean, full disclosure, this is kind of the bread and butter of what I do with patients who have insomnia problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that treatment is, it's a short treatment. I always like to tell people that. It usually takes, you know, a couple months to get everything back on track. Which, you know, if you haven't slept for 15 years, that's not so bad. And what we do is we try to figure out the best possible sleep schedule for each person. And then we try to tackle all the other things that might be interfering with a good night's sleep. So that might include things like, what's your attitude when you get into bed? What are you doing in the evening? How are you starting your day? you know, what if you do wake up at night, what are you doing in the middle of the night? Are you lying in bed and tossing and turning and getting mad at yourself for 2 hours? Are you getting up and watching, you know, movies that get you too amped up and you can't fall asleep? Like, what are you doing, and how can we set up the circumstances for a good night of sleep? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I mentioned, usually I meet with people maybe 4 or 5 times, and it's kind of a series of experiments, you know. I always tell people we should start with something that worked for them in the past, because I think our natural tendencies in general, you know, they're the same. So if you are somebody who needs 8 hours of sleep, you probably still need about 8 hours of sleep. If you're somebody who felt pretty good on 6 for most of your life and you go on vacation and you still sleep 6 hours, you're probably going to sleep 6 hours now too. So that's the thing that works the best. The other thing I notice a lot with older patients that I see is that they tend to do a lot of things in their bedroom besides sleeping. Right. Maybe they have, you know, back pain, and so they go in their bed and they rest for a couple hours in the middle of the day. And so once they start doing that, then maybe they put a TV in their bedroom, and then once they're watching TV in their bedroom when they're lying down to rest, they end up turning it on and watching TV in bed in the morning. And then the next thing you know, if we look at all the time that they're spending in their bed or their bedroom, it adds up to a lot. So right. Another thing we focus on is making sure that when you get into bed, it's with the intention of actually sleeping. Mm-hmm. So that we aren't spending time doing all sorts of other things there during the day.
Yeah, yeah. So I have 2 follow-up questions about that. The first one is going back to the original question. You know, the patient comes in, they say, I haven't slept at all. I don't think I'm ever going to sleep again. I don't know what to do. Is it scientifically, biologically, physiologically possible for a person to not sleep at all for several weeks?
It is possible for a day. It is possible for probably 2 days. And then it's not very possible after that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because what can happen is, first, when we're very sleepy, we have these like really short periods of sleep. Some people have referred to them as micro sleeps. So your brain will sort of doze off for a few seconds. But the more sleep deprived you are, the more your brain craves sleep. So if you just ate breakfast right now, you're not going to be hungry. If you haven't had anything to eat for 3 days, you're going to be very, very hungry. So I like to think about it that, you know, your brain, when it's starved for sleep, it will get it no matter what. You know, I work with a lot of folks who are military veterans, and they'll talk about, you know, falling asleep standing up because they were so sleep deprived. And the challenge, though, is sometimes people who are struggling with sleep, they don't know that they fell asleep. So they'll come in and they're not lying. They will say, I haven't slept for 2 weeks. And I actually try to reassure them that your brain won't let that happen. It really won't. And your experience might be that you just sat on the couch and you're kind of resting. But I promise that your brain is insisting that you get at least a little bit of sleep. And sometimes the more you struggle with insomnia, the harder it is to perceive that you've fallen asleep. So when somebody is in that situation, a lot of times we have to work on, you know, focusing on not so much how many hours of sleep that you got, but how much time you're spending awake when you're trying to sleep. Because we know how much time goes by when we're awake, within reason. I mean, we can guess. Once we fall asleep, we have no idea how much time has passed.
Right. Yeah, I think back to some of the patients I've dealt with and where they say, you know, I don't sleep at all. I can't sleep. I haven't slept in days. And then as we dig into it and I say, you know, are you sure you weren't taking naps? No, I haven't taken naps. And then we dig a little further and then you get, well, you know, there are those times I notice that I'll sit down to watch a TV show and the next thing I know, the credits are rolling and I don't know what happened in between.
That's right.
And so, like you say, they're not lying. They don't realize it.
Uh-huh. That's true. I always use the air quotes, resting my eyes.
Right.
Which, you know, I mean, and again, I try to use that to reassure people that your brain won't let that happen to you. It just
right.
won't. Now,
right.
the trick is making sure you're not in unsafe situations when it does happen. So that's not a good time to be on a long car drive or, you know, in a situation where, you know, you have to be responsible for taking care of another person and you can't be alert. But, you know, again, the your brain just won't let that happen. And
right.
that's good. It's right. a safety mechanism.
Yes, yes. Well, this is a perfect spot for us to take our next commercial break. And when we come back, I have another follow-up question about CBTI. So we're going to jump to commercial, and we'll be back in just a minute.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck. Fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, this is Andrew Kolsky, host of Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Dr. Jennifer Martin about sleep and the elderly, and we were talking about CBTI as something that can be used to help with insomnia. And my question to you is, you know, I've had situations where people will come in and I'll describe CBTI to them, and they'll say things like, well, I tried that for a night, and it didn't help at all, or even, you know, I tried that for a whole week and nothing changed. What's going on there?
Yeah, I kind of think about it like baking chocolate chip cookies, right? Any one ingredient is not enough to make a cookie. Mm-hmm. You actually need all the ingredients at the same time, and they have to be combined in the right order. So my response to that when people say, I've tried all these things and none of them work, is, you know, I like to say, well, maybe you just didn't get the recipe right. Maybe what mm-hmm. we can work on together is putting, again, all the ingredients in the right order. It's also the case that some of the recommendations that we use in CBTI don't work in one night. They work over time. So, mm-hmm. You know, you got to put the cookies in the oven. I love metaphors,
right.
by the way. And I love food, so I love talking about food metaphors. I do think that that's really important. So insomnia develops in the first place because we're doing things that are bad for our sleep over and over and over again. And mm-hmm. we can't fix it in one night.
Right.
And as I said, it requires a little bit of experimentation because every individual is different. You know, we're not all exactly, you know, 5'7". We're all a little bit different. So what works for one person may not work at all for someone else. So, you know, when we're doing cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia or CBTI, we always have people keep track of their sleep. Usually I just have people do it with the paper and pencil sleep diary or an app on their phone. And we're monitoring the improvement. And if we're seeing, you know, maybe things are getting a little bit better, we might say, wow, let's stick with this for another week. If, you know, someone I'm working with tries a schedule and it doesn't work, we'll make adjustments. There is a little bit of trial and error involved. The really good news about CBTI, and we've actually done a study with older adults where we did CBTI and we followed them for a year. And a year after the end of treatment, they were still sleeping better. So the good news is it works really well over a long period of time. Even if the person has struggled with insomnia for a decade or more, once we get their sleep on track, it tends to stay that way. And it's only maybe 20%, 30% of people who struggle with sleep on a chronic basis again. And then usually we just go back to what was working during CBTI and their sleep gets back on track.
Right. Okay, so that I clarify this, taking our whole conversation together so far, am I right in saying that if somebody has insomnia, they go through CBTI, they get back on track, then there's really no benefit or no need for any sleep medications?
Actually, that is absolutely a true statement and a very important one to keep in mind, because I think when people want to get off of a sleeping pill, doing CBTI at the same time is really helpful. So as opposed to, I like to think about it as opposed to taking away a treatment, we're substituting a natural treatment for a medication.
Nice.
Because CBTI really relies on all the things that our body already knows how to do. It's just putting them together in the right package.
Great, great. So it's good news for those people who don't want to have to be taking medications, that there is an option that can help solve that. So, great. Well, I appreciate that. So let me shift gears for a minute here. And because we're talking about the elderly, I think we need to talk about living situations, because you've got some who are living at home by themselves, some living with family, then some with long-term care or assisted living, hospitals, nursing homes. Are there differences when it comes to where they're living?
The big differences are in the environment itself. So, and there are pluses and minuses. So one of the, you know, when an older person lives at home alone, I think the biggest threat to sleep is not having enough to do, and, you know, kind of drifting into spending too much time in bed or taking long naps during the day. I think this can be especially problematic when people start to restrict their driving, or, I mean, often for good reasons, because they don't see well at night or things like that. But, you know, you have a lot of control over your sleep environment when you're living in your own home. And typically, I think for older folks, if they're living with family members, they still can control, you know, the environment where they sleep, their bedroom. They can have the mattress and bedding and the lighting and all the things that they like. Once people move into an environment where they don't have as much control of those things, we actually see sleep problems getting worse. I started my career decades ago studying sleep in people who were in long-term care and in nursing home settings. And there were a couple of really important observations. One is, in settings like that, the same is true in the hospital too, people spend a lot of time in bed during the day. So instead of having a solid block of sleep at night, what ends up happening is sleep is kind of distributed across the day and night. People don't feel alert during the day, and they don't sleep solidly at night. Some of that is because of the environment itself. You know, when people are in long-term care, they tend to not get outside and get sunlight. They are less active during the day. At night, there's a lot of clinical care activities going on, and that can be really disruptive to sleep. You know, there are so many studies about how noisy hospitals are at night. Anyone who's been in a hospital knows that the last thing you're going to get in a hospital is a decent night of sleep.
For sure.
So, yeah, and I mean, we... that's a big challenge. And I know there are a number of people, in the nursing field who are trying to come up with strategies to reduce the impact of clinical activities in the hospital on sleep at night. And since mm-hmm. older people are hospitalized more, I think it affects them disproportionately.
Right, right. So on that same vein, are there things that the facilities could do differently? And if you are someone who is in the facility, if you're an elderly patient in a facility like that, are there things that you can do? Like, is there any benefit to eye shades or earplugs or any of these yeah. other types of things?
I would say there's kind of two daytime things and two nighttime things. So during the day, take advantage of all the activities that are available to you. You know, even if you're a resident of an assisted living facility and you think, well, I'm not really into that kind of music, but the alternative is that you stay in your apartment and you sleep all day. Just get out, do things. One of the big important things is being out of bed and eating meals together. So a lot of assisted living and nursing home facilities have community dining rooms. There's two benefits there. One is people who eat with other people eat better. They eat more nutritious food. And it gets you up and moving and active and, again, not sleeping during the day. So I think those are two really important things. If it's appropriate for the weather, get outside and get some sunshine every single day. Mm-hmm. There's actually some data that just increasing light exposure during the day can really be helpful. And if you're visiting somebody who's in a hospital or a nursing home, take them outside. You know, that's a great opportunity. I remember, you know, years back when my father was hospitalized, whenever we would go visit, I'd talk to his nurse. And we get him kind of out on the patio to get some sunlight. And I think it really kind of elevates your spirits. And like I said, it's good for your sleep. Now, the nighttime is tricky. One of the things that I think is important is to try to think about nighttime sleep routines when you put people in a room together. So if you have one resident who needs a lot of care at night and one who needs none, putting them together will make them both sleep poorly. So, And I think, you know, to some extent, residents and their families have to be advocates. So if that's a problem, you know, speak up about it and say something. And, you know, sometimes adjustments can be made. The other thing is, you know, try to keep your room dim and quiet at night. So the things that you can control, turn off your television, you know, don't leave the lights on all night. In people in the hospital, sometimes bringing an eye mask and or wearing earplugs at night can be helpful. Hospitals don't usually provide them, but some will if you ask. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, that's a great tool. If there are a lot of interruptions at night, for example, someone is coming in and checking your blood pressure all the time or things like that, you can always ask your doctor if that's necessary. Sometimes there are things that, you know, once the physician asks for something like blood pressure every 2 hours, no one ever kind of stops to think, like, do we really have to do it every 2 hours at night? What if we did it every 4 hours at night? So again, advocate for yourself. And if something like that is going on and it's really bothering you, just ask if it's necessary. It might be, but it might just be that the way it was documented in the chart, you know, the nurses are just following the instructions. And I always like to remind people that when you're in the hospital or you're in a nursing home, the people taking care of you are in the middle of their workday. Mm-hmm. They don't think about it as a time for sleep.
Right.
So I think another important consideration is that facilities should really educate their staff about how important it is that people who are the residents or the patients are able to get a good night's sleep at night. Even though they are busy and running around and doing all the things that they need to do as part of their job, they should be aware and try to do it in a way that doesn't wake up patients or residents.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And, you know, and I can understand it from both sides. You've got people
exactly.
who are working in the hospital and they're trying to do their best and they're running around. But like you said, for them, it's the middle of their day,
though
it may be
yeah.
2 in the morning.
Right.
So,
yep.
And then, you know, for those people in the rooms, you know, I think one of the biggest tips that you gave is in the morning, open the shade, get the natural light coming in the window, start your day, start that circadian, you know, keep the circadian rhythm in rhythm. Exactly. but we are actually out of time. So time flew quickly here, but I really appreciate the information. You gave us a lot of really good information about medications and treatments and options. So for those of you that are listening, this, if you want to actually see Dr. Martin, you can see this on YouTube a week after this is out on the radio broadcast. And be sure to visit us at sleepsciencetoday.com. You can sign up to be on our newsletter list. You'll get a copy of a free ebook, and you will be able to see bonus episodes and other special treatments. So thank you for tuning in, and we look forward to seeing you on our next episode.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.